Welcome to Beltaloda, the officially unofficial podcast of The Expanse on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 9, titled Winnipesaukee. That's how I'm saying it. I know you New Hampshireites, that's what they're called, are going to be upset with me because it's probably Winnipesaukee or something. I don't know.
I don't know. You'd have to go back and ask the Abenaki people of North America because that's their word.
Okay.
Did you look at the history of the meaning of the word?
No.
Smile of the Great Spirit, or another translation read, beautiful water in high places. So it's a good thing it's high places because it had been swamped with tidal waves.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned in the last episode that like I looked up this island that she was talking about and it didn't exist in New Island or in New Hampshire or wherever she was talking about it. It turns out I think she was talking about an island in this lake because this lake also hosts hundreds of islands.
Gotcha.
So it's a large lake, largest lake in the state. Now, New Hampshire, one of the smallest states in the union. But that's what they were. It wasn't an artificial man-made island. It's an inland lake island.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
So what do you think of this episode, Winnipesaukee?
I spent so much time looking into the meaning of the name that I actually haven't thought about it. They doubled down on me not knowing what the fuck Naomi's doing this episode. And I didn't have any I was waiting in the credit sequence for her as she's banging on stuff, being like, I'm doing this kind of Mark Watney shit and you'll appreciate it next episode. But I didn't get it. So that was kind of weird, but the Amos stuff is really great. And I've said some things critical about like how I said, you know, maybe they pulled back on this stunt sequence because they ran out of budget, whatever. Maybe they spent it all in this episode because you got like a 5-minute running gun battle at the end that I thought was pretty well executed.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. I'm not sure what they're doing with Clarissa Mao and her like tribe approach, because it seems like it's self-evidently wrong even in this episode, or maybe she's taking it too far, but maybe that's something they're doing with her and Amos, and you know, Amos needing someone holding his leash and he's only as good as the person that does it. What did you think about all that?
Yeah. I don't know. The thing about The Expanse is they typically go pretty realistic with this stuff. And so you don't just have these cut and dry sort of moral of the week, right? This isn't some CBS afternoon special or whatever.
Right. So
they're going to have a lot of complex dynamics at play. And one of those things that we've seen recently is about the monsters, right? Is Amos a monster? Well, Claire defines him as a monster. He might start defining himself as a monster. He needs to get back to Holden and his ship because they keep him monster free. There's a big question. Like, can you expand the tribe? Is everyone, does that rule apply to everyone about expanding the tribe? Is it that sometimes you need to protect the tribe? There are a lot of complex dynamics at play, and I think that's what makes the show so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Lesser shows might just say, hey, we need to expand the tribe, and then prove that point over and over and over again, whereas Expanse will maybe disprove it a couple times along the way.
Yeah, this butler is actually Alfred, and he's been trained by Batman to be a combat medic or whatever. But I will say that the first time I saw this episode, I was like, good God, Peaches, you are so up your ass. This is stupid, self-evidently stupid. The second time I watched it, I'm like, I still think ultimately she's wrong in this situation, mm-hmm. but in like a philosophical sense of a like, man, if you could do civilization over, maybe we could do X, Y, Z. It makes a lot of sense.
And that's the thing, but like I said, in the moment, yeah, you might not be able to do that. But if you had rewound, you know, maybe even a year here, right, and brought these people into your tribe earlier, started like not creating the adversarial atmosphere that's going on right now, then yeah, you could have absolutely prevented this particular scenario.
Yeah. And you know, also like, is it ever too late, or is it ever too early to start
right,
trying to do things different? And like, if we are a tribe of two, that's like literally You know, if you, there's no such thing as a tribal one. So like, that's the smallest you can get a tribe. Like maybe it's an interesting argument, and the action of the show, like it's like idealism meets pragmatism in like a 45 minute passion play here. Yeah. It was an interesting thing to think about as I was sitting watching on a second, and I even fired it up for a third attempt while I was like, you know, doing some research and looking through notes and stuff. And just kind of like, I want, you know, yeah, it's like I said, I think I would have blown those rent-a-cops away, those four rent-a-cops away, and saved a lot of people's lives. But I don't know. Like I said, I wondered, like, I think the opposite of crazy is still crazy. I think like completely turning and being like, well, you know, so many people have died senselessly. We shouldn't just kill people with no reason. I guess those guys were giving you reasons, but I don't know.
Yeah. I also feel you when you say that, you know, they doubled down, they singled down here on me not knowing what the hell Naomi is doing, because I don't remember anything from Naomi's story between like when she sends that transmission and when some other stuff happens. So I can't remember if she does this in the book. And so I'm kind of like, what the hell is she up to? What's she going to do with water? And that's it? Just water? Like, that's all she's got here? I don't know what she can do.
Water plus, it feels like one of these old LucasArts games where it's like, yeah, I've got drips of water and an inner hull and a wrench to bang on things. What combination of this will unlock the next level? I don't know.
And you just keep trying things till it works.
We can speculate at the end. So we'll see. As of the time of this recording, we have not got access to the finale episode. It's the one thing that they've withheld us on the screeners. So we might have to wait to find out in real time with the rest of the world on this one. But yeah, I was like, well, I don't know, but I want to see the next episode immediately.
Yeah, and I feel vindicated. I don't know, something about Pastor. When I'm like, you know, he gave that speech a little too fervently. He slipped into that gear a little too easily. I thought that he was pushing back against Delgado pretty hard last episode, but then he just goes along with everything he wanted, including launching an attack on Palace, which is like the home base-ish of Marco, right? If he has a home base, that's it. So like, and then they wanted to attack Ceres. That's, in my opinion, a step too far. I don't know.
Now you felt like you were vindicated. I was reverse unvindicated, because I really like Pastor. I thought they could build him into an interesting little a character that doesn't. But he does seem like he's the anti-President Rosalind, where Rosalind goes in there and just starts like backhanding admirals and kicking fleet commanders in the nuts and being like, you will respect the Department of Education. Where this guy is just like rolling over, wetting himself and doing what other admirals say. And to be fair, it does seem like the public reaction, like, you know, it's one of those things where he's like a first time leader, not comfortable with command. He got his hands on the dial that says pacifism, bellicose, and he keeps turning it and looking back at the audience like, do you like this? And you know, everyone's cheering as the stations are going up in flames. So, and I bet they would. I bet 90% of people on Earth in this circumstance would absolutely want for blood.
He's just looking at the wrong audience.
It's the leader's responsibility to minimize bloodshed, period. Not give the people exactly what they want, which is lots more of the same. So, another interesting. We should probably just start talking about the episode, because I'm going to start like talking in detail about what I like the things about these scenes if we don't.
Yeah, let's do it.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest First Run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We start out the episode with Marco getting some real bad news, I think, about a fleet action, and also, even worse, the status of one Naomi Nagata being dead, which is, surprise, she's not.
Yeah, they talk about, like, him losing ships. Okay, one to two, right? They kill two Martian, or two UN ships, and he loses a frigate or whatever.
He lost five, so there's five Golden Bow Raiders, which I think so those aren't his ships. I think those are just like your standard Belter warships, which are not, you know, super great.
Well, they also said he lost a frigate, right?
No, that there's that they engaged two UNN cruisers and one Martian frigate. And then there's four Golden Bow killed, one UNN cruiser destroyed, and one Martian frigate reportedly lost. So he took out two of the enemy ships, lost four of his, but they're not his. They're his allies.
It's confusing because the Martians are on both sides of this, right? The Martian ships. They're on Marco's side and they're on the inner side.
There's a shadow government at some level behind the belt, but like Mars officially, I don't think, you know, is behind it. But of course, that gets confused later by the UNN as well.
Well, the Belters, like, the point is, like, they can't afford to lose ships, right? The Belters,
they can't
have no ships in effect, right? They don't have warships. Right. They have ice haulers. They have utility ships.
And they have Marco's fleet, which is substantial, but could not stand toe to toe against probably even half of the combined Martian and they talked about that point early on
in the series about, like, the Martians have the superior weapons, but they don't have the numbers. The UN has the numbers. That's the only thing keeping them at a standstill. So if Martians are only giving a fraction of that to Marco, he's not going to be able to stand toe to toe with anybody.
And they said, or like two episodes ago, an admiral who had full knowledge at this point of what Marco had said that what they just have at the gate is capable of fending off any conceivable attack from Marco's powerful fleet. So I think that Marco is like, you know, I mean, that's the thing. Like, you've done this dashing, daring attack. Like, this is kind of like 9/11. Now, what are you going to do with it? And if your answer is lead the UN and Martians around the solar system, having them pound civilian targets, getting the belt whipped up, then you're probably doing the mission's probably working out pretty good for you.
I guess the question is what purpose does that serve? Like, is he trying to create more human shield scenarios, right? Because, like, let's say he does whip up the entire belt. The belt is super pissed off. Nobody's willing to work for the inners anymore. You know, how effective is this strategy in getting what he wants? And what does he want, I guess? Is he trying here to bring about the extinction of the inners, period? Is he trying to simply secure some kind of balance of power here?
I mean, his stated goal is to essentially interdict the inners onto their own planets. Like, you like the gravity well so much, you stay in it, and then we rule the skies. But I mean, it all depends. Like, you know, if Earth's biosphere collapses, which has been discussed, you know, the belt's going to, and whatever meager agriculture resources they have is going to be real super fucking important. Mm-hmm. And the inner's incentive is to not pound all the civilian populations, because, that, you know what I mean? It's like, I can see ways where it's like the inner's can't fully commit to scorched earth because they need that earth. They can't afford to scorch it anymore. But that's the thing. I've never understood what is his. And the fact that maybe the Earth and Mars can't survive without exploiting the belt at this point. So if you can just, like, make the entire belt rise up and pitch a fit and, you know, withhold their resources from, maybe that.
But what does that look like, withholding resources? Because let's not forget, the Earthers or the Inners, you know, Martians and Earthers built the belt in the first place, right? These people used to be Earthers and Martians. Why couldn't they just, you know, scorch Earth, Ceres and Ganymede and all these places that, like, the Belters currently control, just remove them from power and replace them with individuals from their societies?
I guess it seems like the largest union busting of all time. Like, you'd have literally, you know, like, say if there's like a 500,000 people on Ceres, what size of a force would you need to pacify those people and remove them?
Mm-hmm.
Could you get it there without them destroying Ceres? Can you live with the destruction of Ceres? Like, how, like, you know, like, if Earth has eight, it's frustrating because I can't accurately quite understand the solar situation here, because I don't understand exactly, you know, how bad is Earth off, how scared, because the UN, it doesn't seem like they're talking about, like, oh God, we have to figure out how we're going to feed people in 18 months. It does seem like they're obsessed and just like, well, it's business as usual, let's strike back.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is strange.
And also, It is strange. And it's seeming less and less like we got a true nuclear winter situation, and more of we just had enough temporary cloud cover to have an unseasonable snow shower. Because, like, you know, we saw the sun shining today in this episode. So,
yeah, is it already winter before the rocks hit? Because, like, none of the trees have leaves, and
you're
not
going to
blow the
that.
Leaves off of a tree with, you know, while leaving everything else untouched, and they're not going to drop off that fast from the cold.
Maybe it would if you had, like, this, like, you know, fire cloud, you know, firestorms sweeping through.
Firestorms,
raw kinetic energy.
Well, if you look at it, it's like some trees have lost their leaves, clearly the ones that aren't evergreens, and then the evergreens still have all their needles and stuff. So I would think like some kind of crazy firestorm would take the needles off of a tree as well as the leaves.
Yeah, so, you're not wrong.
So it's tough, right? Like if it's winter on Earth and then the nuclear winter happens, what does that mean? Yeah. How can I tell the difference?
I guess if Marco was counting on all like 9 or 10 rocks hitting and really truly crippling Earth, where it's like they can't even hardly feed, then all he has to worry about is maybe squaring off against Mars. So we know his plan didn't go off the plan. So how worried is he? The bottom line is when the Belter gave this battle report, the look on his face seemed like, oh, Jesus, we lost that many ships. Well, mm-hmm. you know what? It was worth it. It's worth the cost. Because what else is he going to say? He's going to fucking go full on to like back Hitler in the last days of Bunker screaming. And, you know, like, is he going to go full on downfall at this stage? But he's trying to keep it. But I think that's what you're supposed to understand about this scene, that these losses are more than he can sustain for objectives that probably aren't worth this kind of losses.
And yet he keeps that, you know, the face of a winner, right? He tries
until
to
he starts pounding
this.
The table in frustration. But that's the Naomi brought that out of him, so.
Right? As she always does.
So Alex and Bobby aboard the screaming Firehawk, and also Holden, Bull, and Monica simultaneously are debating the meaning of this strange signal they've got from the chain smoker. This odd comms malfunction that has changed Naomi's distress message into one of empowerment and control. And what can they do about it?
Yeah, what to make of it, what to do about it. I don't know that I have a ton to say about that. Like, they're kind of just piecing together the things we already know. So,
and it's a good scene of smart people trying to work through a problem. I'm surprised that no one, the only thing that I wish is somebody, maybe someone that like Bull or Monica, that would be more skeptical, probably Bull, like, hey, what if this is a trap? You know, like, because the proximity sensors and bombs and stuff, that's got to be like a Belter tactic 101. It's like an, mm-hmm. you know, IED, leaving an abandoned vehicle when someone come, you know, make a call on it. When someone comes investigate, blow them up. Like, no one, I wish someone would put in that. And but then I guess that the jig would be up. And I'm starting to think that there's a lot of maybe things that you shouldn't think about on this plot, or the jig would be up, going back to some of my complaints of last episode. But I think they're doing the best they can here.
Yeah, the thing I like about this scene is that they are now on the Holden train to the Chet Smoker, right? Like, the thing they're realizing here is they're not getting off this ride until they figure out what's up with Naomi. There's, you know, that look from Holden. Bull's like, oh, I'm not sure. We're running pretty low on fuel. And then Holden just looks at him, just glowers at him, and he's like, I'll see if I can do something about that.
Do you think there's a time where they will kind of like, you know, 25th Amendment Holden and be like, look, there are 20 people on board this thing. 19 of us have no personal connection to Naomi and hold our lives dear. What mm-hmm. the fuck? I get this is your ship, but, you know, no, we are not going along with this. What are you going to do? Draw a gun and kill us all for it? And what are you going to do when Naomi finds out? All Holden's got over these guys is their goodwill and shared purpose. Mm-hmm. And he's losing both. So I wonder if there might be like a soft mutiny, not like a I hate you and I'm going to throw you at the airlock mutiny, but kind of like, hey, Jim, we're not doing this anymore mutiny next episode.
Yeah.
Which might ironically save them all.
Could be.
But yeah, the thing that's frustrating is like, well, there's no way to know where we can until we get there. Let's get there as fast as possible. So it's like Naomi probably wishes they would, you know, conserve your fuel a little bit. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Naomi tries to harvest some frost from the chain smoker's inner hull because she's slowly dying of thirst and rapidly dying of her friend's love for her. What you gonna do, Jim?
I don't know. It seemed weird to me that she would be like on her way back as she's panting and gasping for air, for oxygen. She notices, she gets distracted by the ice on the wall, and she's like, ooh, that looks tasty. She's like standing there scraping it off, dying, like dying as she's doing it. All you got to do is step out into the ship for a second to get some air back into your suit and come back for the water, Naomi. Like, I get it. You've been out here a lot, but it's not worth dying over.
Yeah, especially since it's like as much exhaustion and exertion she's going through, it's like, man, she's got to be squirting out more than that few drops of water in sweat. But
that too.
Thirst is a paradoxical son of a bitch. You know, you'll get to a point where you're so thirsty, you drink seawater, even knowing that it's going to kill you just because you can't fucking stand it no more. However, it's like, as I was watching this for multiple episodes or multiple times through, the second time I remember leaning forward and be like, I'm going to pay attention to everything and I'm going to figure out what she's doing. And she looks up and she sees this like bare patch of wire on one of these tamper resistant or remote control things. And I'm like, that bare strip of wire. OK, you got to remember that. Nah, it doesn't matter. She's just going to use it to rig into to tap into her helmet to sensors and stuff. I could figure out what she's doing by the end of the episode.
Yeah. Same here.
Amos Peaches and company stealthily approach a mansion on the island estate neighborhood community under cover of darkness. We kind of do this kind of flyover where we see the layout of the neighborhood and we end up keying on a particular garage, a space garage, it turns out.
Hmm. I can't remember if the name of this ship is the same in the books. I'm pretty sure it's not. If I had to guess, the name of the ship in the book is something penis related, because that's what the Corys like to do.
Really?
God.
The penis contorters?
Right. The penis contorters, the racing penis. It's all penises to them. And to be fair, like, ships are pretty phallically shaped.
It would be funny if Ty and or Die or Dan's penis was tattooed like the Razorback, you know, that dot pattern, the history of flight. Yeah,
Up one side of it. I'm sure it is. I think they mentioned something on their podcast about showing that at the season finale. So we'll get to see.
Really?
It.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you look up this ship name? Because I tried to, and I couldn't find much.
So Ravetta Bowers is an old lady alive right now. I think she's in her mid-70s. She serves an important function in the California school system. Mm-hmm. Particularly, she was the head of schools in Los Angeles for over 40 years. She's recently retired and she sits on a lot of boards, some for Walt Disney, some for Blizzard and Activision. So she's like cashing in on a lifetime of civil service. I don't know whether this is someone who is a good friend of Dan or Ty's or someone in the production or it's someone that they think has done a lot for their community. But like, I don't know, like it's possible this lady is famous in the 24th century for some kind of education. This is some kind of charity work that they're involved in. But like, that's what I found out about her.
Yeah. So we obviously record these podcasts in advance before the podcast that, you know, Wes Chatham and some of the authors and actors that they do. So I'm hoping that by the time, you know, this is out, they'll actually have some information about that in their podcast, because I would like to know. I'm curious.
Mm-hmm. I did like the comedy that they play, like, you know, these it's funny that the butler and the chef and the maid hide in the garage because they think surely the people are there to ransack the house. And that's the exact opposite. And then they recognize Clarissa and they start like doing the chit chat stuff. And Eric's like, cut the shit, you know, like we'll have time for the tearful unions later. Some of that stuff that happens throughout the episode, I thought, what was pretty funny.
Yeah. Amos's line about depends on what you're trying to steal, you know, when they're talking about where the thieves would go.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, they established the fact that the ship hasn't flown in 2 years, which sets up a little, you know, mini conundrum. I thought it was good. Also, I thought the Ravetta Bowers is a damn fine looking ship, and they really nail that very peculiar kind of luxury yacht look. You know, where it's all kind of like polished chrome and velour. Mm. And it's not like any kind of recognizable residential design or even naval design. It's just some kind of weird, like, this is mid-level luxury yacht detailing. And I fully buy, because it hasn't changed much, like from the 70s to today. You know, it's all kind of like the same kind of deal, maybe uglier pastels. And maybe more basic colors, but like the actual look. Pink. Yeah, yeah. No, I thought the inside. Yep, this looks exactly like a rich person's moon dinghy. Yep.
Well, it looks a lot like the Mal's personal ship, right? That we saw in like season three?
Very same aesthetics, yeah.
Yeah, when Abbasrala and Kotiar, Cortazar, whichever one that is.
When Bobby was two-fisting the cucumber sandwiches.
Uh-huh, yeah. Back when we were on that ship. It looks a lot like that. So, yeah, it's it's all of a piece.
So the UN strikes back at the palace station like they were threatening to last episode, causing people on Luna to cheer, but Avasarala to flip her shit on Admiral Delgado and resign her position in disgust on the UN cabinet.
Yeah, and that inspires some of the others to resign as well on the spot. Wow. Yeah, this took a turn, man. I thought that this pastor guy was going to hear all sides and come down on the school teacher side, which is probably, compassion, maybe understanding the emotion of the situation. No, he's going full on war with potentially even Mars. I think they talked about how Callisto is like a Martian installation. If they hit that, they might start a war with the rest of Mars. This is crazy.
The Admiral's like, it doesn't matter. They're already complicit. Fuck them, you know.
But how will the Martians feel? And this line that that he gives about, like, we can't let emotion make this decision is the exact. It makes the decisions for you whether you want it to or not. Emotion is the factor at play here, and that is exactly the point that Avasarala is trying to make when she talks about how this is going to unite the Belters, and you're talking now about uniting Mars against them if they go ahead with this Callisto attack. What the hell?
That is a naked appeal to listen to another set of emotions. Like, they're saying, "Oh, yes. you're too empathetic and sympathetic, and you're having too you're soft." But we have to listen to the angry, bellicose emotions. Like, truly taking emotions out of the equations would probably be a good idea, but that's not what they're arguing for.
Well, they're arguing
never what they're arguing for.
Their own emotions overriding the emotions of the Belters when they get attacked, right? Like,
right.
That's the thing, and that's always been the view of the UN, right? It's UN-centric. It's inner-centric, earther-centric. Fuck the Belt. And they're falling right back into that old pattern, which is exactly why we're in this situation in the first place. And the fact that Avasarala is the only one who really sees that or at least voices it in this moment is kind of scary, because I thought this pastor guy was better.
Yeah. And to be fair, half the cabinet takes off with her, which I thought was interesting. But like what you're saying is right. Like Avasarala saying, when she's like, you know, we can't attack these civilian targets. It's like, oh, like Marco did to us. And she's like, what, is he our fucking role model now? Oh, are we just following the terrorist playbook? Is that like, that's such a great, I thought that was such a great response.
Yeah.
And you know, her saying that, like, hey, in a real politic way, this isn't, you know, Marco wants the Belt to be united behind him, but the reality is he's not. There's factions that we could work with that they saw an alternative versus, cause that's, you know, if Drummer suggested, hey, we run to the UN and tell them we're on their side, that we've had enough, you know, like Michael Rooker in Tombstone, to bring in a reference we just talked about, like,
throw,
you know,
red,
like,
sash out.
I used to be a cowboy, but no more of this red sash stuff. I saw what they did to your station. I saw what they did with the asteroids. Like, if that was an option that they actually believed would work, I 100% think that the Drummer's crew starts burn and making a hard burn towards Earth and Mars, right?
Yeah.
But both, you know, quote unquote, both sides are ramping up the tensions. The worst impulses of both sides are ruling the day so far. And I also like Avasarala admitting that, like, look, I get it. Like, you know, we've been wondering about Arjun. She's fully, you know, she's fully now accepting. This episode's about her accepting Arjun's death. She's like, look, I want to take this bastard and throw him up on the hooks and watch, like, I kind of, like, too far for my taste. Like, I would love to get his family in there, watch him take his dying gasps as I cackle in delight over, like, she goes into really dark places and be like, but, you know, that's not what we're supposed to be doing here. We're supposed to be doing what's actually going to keep people safe and ratchet these tensions down. They also, and you know, this, like, her basic math, this is something that, like, even the U.S. Army's own counterterrorist manual points out, that these heavy-handed responses take, you ever, for every one partisan you kill, you make 10 more.
Yeah,
that's bad math when you're fighting an counterinsurgency.
Unless you just want to kill them all, like, which seems to be the playbook that Delgado's on, right? Like,
especially as
he just wants to genocide these people at this point.
They want to hit Ceres, the largest place in the belt, the largest population center, which is Anderson Dawes's home base. Mm-hmm. And they completely misread, like, Anderson Dawes is not going to go against Marco because almost no belter will. He's got that big navy. But Anderson Dawes does not like Marco.
No.
You know, he thinks he's doing, you know, so it's, if nothing else, it's competition to his power and ambition. Mm-hmm. And you can exploit that. It's a frustrating scene, but
it is.
It reminded me of our conversation that, you know, the silver or lead conversation we had last week. It's like, you know, I don't really judge too harshly beat cops that, like, street toughs roll up with a gun to their head. But these type of professional politicians, it's orders of magnitude less brave and courageous for them to take these moral stands. And you like to see it not only when they take the moral stand, but when they come out guns blazing about it, too. And I think that they did what they could do, which is like, you know what? What Naomi said, all I can do is walk away from the situation. And they do. And it kind of inspires a soft revolution here.
Yeah. No, by the end of the episode, I'm definitely like, okay, things are back under control. You know, the pot has stopped boiling. It's not going to boil over. At least for the moment. We'll see how Avisarla handles it, but.
Because I would buy that, like, also she's going to be put in some situations where she's going to maybe have to get her pans bloody, you know? Because some people will need to die almost assuredly to wrap this thing up. Meanwhile, over aboard the drummer's faction fleet, Carol threatens Oxania, that's drummer's exo, unless she toes Marco's line and obeys all orders given to her. She's really really nervous about the drummer's infamous anger here.
Yeah. I was pretty sure that by the end of this episode, we were going to see, you know, Oksana tell drummer about the situation. Of course she does. I wonder how long, you know, there's more to talk about this other scenes, but I wonder how long the peace will be kept here on drummer ship. Especially now since, that she knows
Corral seems to be doing everything she can to divide the crew. Like, look at the crew's faces when they're ordered off the bridge so they can have a private conversation. This is no longer a family. This right. obviously reads a suspect to all of them. But now it's like, you know, she's keeping secrets between the two, which she knows is going to divide them. And this crew being divided suits her purposes because, you know, if they're all united against her, they could just throw out an airlock and do whatever the fuck they want. And I think, you know, I obviously Corral is no fool, as Drummer later asserts. But I do think she doesn't really play this as smart as she could. It does seem like she presses her advantage, way too often.
Yeah.
I noticed this thing like in Tony Soprano. I've been watching Sopranos in my free time, and I'm on season 2 where he's trying to consolidate power from his Uncle Junior, Uncle June. And he's like just a real shit to all of his uncle's former lieutenants, like berates him and calls him names and stuff. And I'm like, I mean, I get it. He's a New Jersey gangster, right? But the whole time, like, this isn't good politics, man. You should like maybe try to like treat them as your dudes now. And they're going to be really like maybe resistant to that. But like if you treat him, because Uncle June was kind of an idiot and it was just tough working under him. Maybe play a little bit of a softer touch. But I don't know. Maybe gangsters. Maybe that's one of the problems with gangsters. They just don't have the capacity for a light touch.
Yeah. Yeah. The only problem with gangsters, of course.
No,
you're right. She definitely does. Come in here stomping around breaking things, but you know, when somebody feels that they're untouchable, like a Tony Soprano or like a Corral in this situation, this the second officer or something of the, the leader of the Free Navy, like she probably thinks she's got a pretty strong shield here from the consequences of any dissent or any you know, chaos she's sowing. I'm not so sure about that. And none of this is happening in the books, so I'm up in the air on this, but I really don't think she's long for this world. I feel like Drummer, you know, she has her gun taken from her. I think that's an indicator of where things are going, right?
Right. And I felt really bad for Oksana being put in this position, too, because, like, there's really nothing she can do. Like, if she openly resists, then, you know, like, if you don't follow your orders, you'll be a foe of Marco, which you guys just decided 2 episodes ago wasn't what you wanted to be, because you'd be spaced. Someone else would be picking. You know, so your time is to bide your time and wait for something to change the equation. That's all you can do. Like, once you make the decision to take the deal with the devil, then you wait until you can renege on the devil. Mm-hmm. But if nothing's changed in the calculus, then when it's tough. And then when things start changing, which is what we might be seeing towards the end of this episode and ongoing episodes, like when is it premature? When is it ripe? When are you kind of being a coward? Like, I think it's all interesting. And the really interesting thing is no one arrives at those points at the same time. And we've got like a tight knit crew, like, that can destabilize things. And they're just doing such a great job at these dynamics. Mm-hmm. And it's so fascinating to watch. Yes, I'm comparing it to The Sopranos, which is one of the best television shows of all time. Amos and company are dining in style. Crystal, drinkware.
Gold-rimmed glasses.
Gold-rimmed china. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's just like pheasant and duck, and they're just having a Game of Thrones-style feast, only with much better flatware. When their party's interrupted by a crowd of worried seasonal workers outside asking for help.
Yeah, Amos has probably never had a meal like this. Probably never eaten off dishes like this. Probably never been served a meal.
Almost certainly, if you're talking about like this. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, maybe Eric has, right? Because he's the king of Baltimore or whatever. But, like,
right.
Amos left before all that happened. So, and he's been out on ice haulers and just out in the verse for a long time.
Even a brothel on Ceres isn't going to, you know, the high roller table isn't going to give you this kind of service. Yeah.
Hell no. So yeah, this is probably a unique experience for him, which is cool. But also weird, I'm sure, especially like mm-hmm. as the earth goes to hell around you to have this meal served to you on literal silver platters. It's crazy.
I bet it feels kind of like a last meal, because that's kind of their situation. If they, you know, they came here, they used up as much of their batteries as they could of the helicopter. And, mm-hmm. you know, what are they going to do if they can't get the ship working?
And when, you know, these people roll up to the gates, I just love Eric telling this old lady to fuck off. Mm-hmm. a lot of foul language, a lot of fucks in this episode. A lot of them coming from Eric. He's got a foul mouth.
He's such a pissy little dick about everything, too.
I love it.
You know, I do, too. It's like, he's just got no fucks, no patience. Like, he is a gangster. He's not trying to be he's not trying to pass off as a good person. So
he also comes across as a little bit of like sort of a I forget what the term is, but it, like, he puffs himself up to look bigger than he is a lot of the time. And you can see there's this dynamic between him and Timothy, right? Where Amos is always kind of taking the lead and he's always sort of deferring to him. You get the impression that when they were growing up, that might have been the situation too. And that even though he's this powerful guy within Baltimore, that dynamic comes back into play when they get in each other's proximity.
I think Amos is the big brother in this relationship.
Yeah.
And there's always that kind of energy that is brought to the table. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of things. I really like the comedy here with, you know, Eric's like soberly assessing the battery situation with the freeze, and like the butler's like, yeah, we're also almost out of food. And then there's this like long pause. He's like, oh, but you're welcome to as much as you'd like. This passive aggressive, like, you're eating all of our food, you assholes.
Also, and the butler, like I can imagine the butler trying to say that to Mao or somebody, right? Like, oh, we're almost out of food. Like, trying to limit their mm-hmm. consumption, their gluttony in any way. It's like, this guy stepped out of line if he's talking to Mao, and he thinks he stepped out of line here talking to Amos, but like, he's probably, like, if you tell Amos we're almost out of food, he's going to start rationing, he's going to start, you know, making a survival go of it. But this guy instinctively reacts as if he said something wrong that he's going to be fired for or punished for.
I kind of wish I kind of wish the butler was played a little bit more like Mr. Carson from Downton Abbey. Like, just like, he has zero power, but he's still going to just make a big stink, and he's going to raise his eyebrow at everything, and he's going to make it very clear that, like, you're welcome as much of this food, you unwashed caveman. I'm not approving of any of this stuff. Like, it'd be funnier if he played him with a little bit more like lack of class consciousness there. What do you think? I also really like the appreciation of, like, you know, it has to be mechanical, electrical, or software. It reminds me of my dad and I working on small engines. He's like, it's got to be fuel, spark, or air. Like, yeah. And so, you know, if you
anything.
Don't, that's exactly, that's what's, but you know, it's funny, is the older I get, I'm like, Jesus Christ, dad knew what he's talking about. Like, maybe not in fuel injectors and shit like that. But back in the old days, like, yeah, you start taking shit apart and knowing what thing provides what, and like, oh, well, this is dirty and it probably shouldn't be, this thing's sticking when it should slide, like, and I feel like that kind of helped me figure out Amos doing the same thing on this fusion reactor, just like running through all the different possibilities. Yeah, he's the mechanical, right? And Julie was the electric. I mean, and it turns out Eric here is an ace hacker, because probably that makes sense. Of course he is in the 24th century. It's a nice little A-team kind of that they got going.
Yeah, and so much of what they're saying here makes sense, right? Like, narrowing down the problem to, you know, what seems to anybody else like, oh, so it could be literally anything. Well, no, that's his way of like saying, I'm thinking through the problem here. And then what they say later, as a former web developer, I deeply understand what Amos says later. Like, sometimes you got to stop thinking about the problem to figure it out. 100%. You got to step away. You get too close to a thing and you get blinded by being too close to it. Just give your brain some time off. Let it kind of percolate and it will figure this thing out.
About these people gathered outside, like, so I'm sympathetic to wanting to take these people with you.
Uh-huh.
However, Julie's like, yeah, it'd be crowded, but it's a short trip. Like, hey, this isn't packing everybody into the minivan for a trip down to like the fucking mall. Okay.
Yeah.
Like, or I guess it is, like, at highway speeds. Why is that a bad idea? You don't have enough seatbelts to go around. You don't have enough crash couches. You don't have enough, like,
in this,
like,
case, oxygen, might, right? Like,
yeah,
potentially.
Yeah. You might pulp the old man when you have a sudden deceleration or something and he goes flying around the cabin. Or, yeah, you might burn up all the oxygen. It's not just lift and delta V. I don't know. I'm like, there is a limit to how many people you can fit on this ship. And maybe she, since she's got extensive penis racing, she's got extensive penis racing experience, so she knows a little bit more about like what these ships are capable of. But
was she the penis racer? I thought Julie was a penis racer.
But she know, I think you're supposed to understand that
she,
like,
also did
her
it.
And Julie probably were very good at it, but like Julie got all of the, you know, because she was better.
Okay,
so she got the team and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, she's taking she's taking a yacht the moon and back for sure. There's no way.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, how have they clued us much into Claire and this, the way like she lived her life, other than just being angry at her father and her sister all the time? Like, I get that.
I mean, she was always like planning. I mean, they said she seemed like she was in charge of like planning all the parties and doing all the social engagements, because Julie had like zero. Like, you know, she was more of the horse girl in the family.
Yeah, she was out racing, wearing the motorcycle jackets. Sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But she threatens to withhold her help. I guess that's like the trump card. Like, they need her electrical expertise to like run this thing down. So also, Amos is looking for an emotional guidance system, you know, like a moral guidance system. So that will be, I think that's the this is understandable. In the next scene we're going to talk about, I'm a little more anti, but like it makes sense in terms of Amos, and we'll talk about it. So. Marco gives the order to Drummer's fleet to hunt down and destroy the Rocinante, because it's going to be a real eternal landmark of cultural significance, rah, rah, blah, blah, blah.
Is this where the guns come out? Literally out of Drummer's pocket into the hands of Oksana?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and it's a great emotional pincher move. I've had it used on me, and I've used it on people before. Like, if someone's like going to cause a problem, you say, hey, you know, you've been drinking, give me your keys. And if they're like, I'm not going to drive, like, well, then you shouldn't have any problem giving me the keys. You know, like it's like, yeah, if a person, like, you know, it'd be one thing if you're a dick and you're always accusing someone of doing something. They're like, fine, take my fucking keys and like you know, you overplay. But like, yeah, if a person asks you to give up something that you're saying is not going to be a problem and you don't, I mean, you're kind of saying it's going to be a problem, right? And I think drummer,
yeah,
the Carrie G is such a great character, G, mm-hmm. that she like plays that emotional conflict, like, you know, doing the like, okay, she's fucking got me, here's my gun,
right?
And again, they just do the personal politics here of like, drummer's a smart person trying to figure out like orders of people that she knows again are many things but not fools, and knowing that something's not adding up. Meanwhile, on Luna, Avasaral puts up a hollow plaque to Arjun's memory. I'm going to pretend it's old Arjun. New Arjun was never a thing. We're never going to this is the memory of old Arjun. She's setting a candle to, mm-hmm. before she gets emergency drafted back into politics.
Yeah, the highest office too. Apparently. Yeah, man, it seems quick to do a no confidence vote on this dude. Like, I get it, half your cabinet resigned or whatever, half your war committee, but like
in like a single day, I mean,
you go from inspiring all of humanity with a speech to out of office in like a day. This guy was Secretary General, so wild.
Yeah, politics moves fast, I guess. Do they do any, are any of these politics in the books?
No, none of this. Our Avasarla is a minor character in the books. Who didn't know, like, she's barely in the books.
Yeah. I like how when the Admiral comes to her, she like briefly says, this is a coup, you'll never get away with it. And the Admiral's like, what? No, I'm here because the Council asked me to, and they thought I would be a politically neutral person to ask the question.
Yeah.
Because I thought like there was going to be, yeah, this like moral and ethical dilemma of like, well, this is what she wants, but, you know, not like this.
Really zero friction to getting this guy out of office, just gone.
Yeah. Yeah. And we bounce over to Delgado's quarters, and he's packing up because he thinks, well, that's it for me. Mm-hmm. And Avasaral essentially insults him by saying, you're too old to lead a strike group. Come on. What the fuck? And I was also. The good guys think that the Marcos faction still thinks that he has a protomolecule. Because that's what Avasaral asserts here. Is that because James Holden is kind of keeping some of this stuff a little close to his vest for some reason? And why? Why would he not immediately report back to Bobby/Avasaral that the protomolecule has been neutralized? What purpose does that serve him? Or is this just like, you know, the communication just hasn't caught up to everybody yet?
Wow. Is it really the case that you can oust the Secretary General faster than you can communicate something to Earth from the belt?
It might literally be true. It's like isn't a several hour delay for light to go from Earth to Mars?
Probably, several hours is all it takes to oust the Secretary General, huh? Holy shit.
I guess if half the cabinet leaves and the other half, like, you know, because in Earth, 25th Amendment, we talked about it. Sure. You only need it like half the cabinet to go along with it. And it's kind of instantaneous at once it happens. So, I mean, there's a lot more to it. Like, but for these purposes, I think it could happen pretty quick. Mm-hmm. She also raises the threat of asteroids, which I guess I had thought was completely off the table now once they got the Watchtower working with the Sentinel system. But mm-hmm. like, she thinks it's still, you know, I've been kind of dismissing those things when people have asked in feedback, but the Avasaral herself could be, she's just twisting his arm. That's the other thing, could be that she's just like putting up a bunch of what ifs to scare him into compliance here. But then we got the long awaited punchline to the joke. And boy, this joke, I don't know if it ever used to be funny.
Is it a joke? I guess he was technically it qualifies as a joke, but it was not funny.
Yeah, I think it's like in other times where it's kind of a joke that like, these people, we deprive them so much belters. Of all their stuff is shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like maybe it's a funny joke and it's structured as such, but it's only funny if you don't really examine it.
Funny if you have callous disregard for an entire portion of humanity.
We get another of those sick shots of 1/10 gravity alcohol pouring. I always like that when they get the CGI out just to fill some bottles and glasses.
Moon booze. Hell yeah.
Moon booze. Drinking some 10th G moon booze. Oh boy, you can taste the difference in gravity. I bet there's places that like advertise like that uniquely peaty taste you can only get from lunar regolith.
God, I would not want my booze anywhere near regolith. Can you imagine like the mouthfeel of a regolith infused booze? No.
Yeah, because isn't the whole idea that like on the moon everything's very sharp and like asbestos glass? No. It tastes like cancer.
My teeth used to have enamel.
It tastes like colorectal cancer. Yeah. Amos's activities repairing the shuttle rather are interrupted once again by outside forces, and instead of butlers and scullery maids, this time it's armed private security goons attempting to do a little robbing and stealing of their own. Oh boy. Mm-hmm. What a confrontation. What do you think, Jim?
I'm with you, Claire, or I'm with you, Peaches. What she's saying makes sense, right? Maybe it's not the time and the place here and now, but like, when is? If not now, when? You know, you got to start somewhere. And yeah, it comes back to bite them immediately, but also you gotta create a path forward that doesn't just involve violence. And like, that's kind of like the theme of this entire episode, right? Is like that inclusion of the tribe. You know, even against like the idea that this could come back, and bite you, some kind of perceived like weakness or the kindness that you're going to show to people could be exploited. It, you know, when do you start? When is the perfect time to start? And if you wait for that perfect time, you're going to miss so many other windows where you could have started. And things are going to get so much worse until then.
Here's my analysis. Like Amos, because at first I'm like, why is Amos going along with this? But then I realized Amos's arc is that he doesn't like if he feels like someone else is a better person than him, he just defers to their judgments. We've seen it with Naomi. We've seen it with Holden. Like if he respects you, and I think Clarissa has gotten to that point. Peaches has gotten to that point. However, I think there's a big difference between how you treat people coming to you with their hands out asking for help and how you come to people with guns drawn wanting to take things from you.
Sure.
And like, I don't think that Holden, if Holden was the one holding the leash here, the Amos, I don't think that Holden lets these guys, I don't know if he puts holes in their head, but I could see him like once you know, got gun superiority over him, like disarming them, tying them up, stuff them in the coat closet and thinking that like, you know what, their dudes will be back later. Hopefully we're gone by then. We haven't killed anybody. It's like the middle path. It's not the opposite of crazy, which is, I think, what Clarissa is doing. And I wonder if this is also something that like Amos will appreciate, like by learning secondhand is like, you know, and also like foresight's or hindsight's 2020. And we know absolutely that 30 plus people die at the end of this episode as a partial direct consequence from Clarissa's action here.
Yeah.
But it feels like, maybe you take him because they don't want him communicating like as soon as they get out of the earshot that there's resistance here. Like, wait for them to miss in a report. Wait for them to kind of search for them. Wait for them to figure out where they're at last. That gives you extra time. Like, I don't know whether because like I don't know whether the show realizes this or the show thinks that like Clarissa is just always right, because I guess I don't agree with that part of the philosophy.
There can be a middle path, certainly one that doesn't involve violence, but still maintains whatever kind of edge, doesn't hand all the cards over to the enemy. Right.
Yeah. Or they might potentially, you know. Yeah, there's ways you could play, like, you know, Avasarala. I'm trying to think of like how you can misplay, you know, overtures to the belt. Like if you just say like, you know, we're never going to ever strike back against the belt, no matter what they do. And we're just going to flood them with relief. Actually, I don't know. Like I said, that's I don't think anyone in the history of the world's tried that approach. But yeah, there's a difference between, you know, Delgado's like sex nuts, crazy bang bang pew pew approach and, you know, utter pacifism. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the show is smart enough to be like kind of illustrating that through this scenario. We'll see. So, you know, Eric's taking my position that it's dumb. And Amos is saying, well, if it's stupid, then we better redouble our efforts so we can get back, get out of here before they get back. Pretty smart. Meanwhile, over in the Drummer faction, Drummer demands to be treated like an adult and is shocked to find out Naomi will still be alive, or may still be alive, and also beside herself that there may be nothing that she can do about it. Mm-hmm. I thought this was a great, great scene.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like there's this two-way street going on in this scene. It's one of respect from both sides, and they both like demand it and earn it in the same scene. They've done a pretty good job sort of connecting the dots between this family on the ship, but it's scenes like these which make me really appreciate it. You know, it's one thing like when they're arguing over whether they should join Marco's faction and do that, when they don't really have much of a choice and they're just sort of arguing over sort of an inevitability. But these scenes where they're like, there are some emotional stakes, right? It's not just, oh, we're going to die if we do this. It's like, well, I could lie to you here. What does that do to our relationship in the future? Right. It's a really good scene.
And from a visual filmmaking standpoint, the conceit of the scene is that there's a literal physical barrier between them.
Yeah.
While there's also an emotional barrier, the secrets and dishonesty. And I love the way they use that, where Drummer is like, accusing her of keeping secrets. And she's like, you know, is it so unthinkable that if I'm holding something back, it's for the greater good? And then continue to like drill into that. And Drummer's like, you know, why can't you treat me like an adult? Like, this guy killed my mentor. My father figure, I said nothing. He killed a woman that I loved, and I said nothing. All to keep you safe. Now he asked me to hunt down this woman's best friends and murder them. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, how much shit do I have to eat before you'll start trust me? And then the barrier opens. Like, you know, literally she steps through and levels with her. And then also, like, I liked attention to detail that after all that speech, Drummer's, as soon as she hears that Naomi's alive, she instantly spins on her heel and is going to set off to the bridge to go rescue her. And Oksana's like, you know, needed a concession from her. It's like, do you love us? Mm-hmm. Like, do our lives matter too? And they do, which is why Drummer is, she isn't going to do something crazy. She's going to do something.
It feels like she has to do something. That's the thing.
There has to be a change in the arithmetic, the balance that she will exploit. Because I don't think she's stupid. She's going to do, and she doesn't want to put her family at stake. But I don't know. There's always this story could go. It could be a story of a person sacrificing one family to save another, or their principles, or it could be someone biding their time for the right moment to take a stand. It's not just a meaningless moral gesture. There's times and places for that. That's kind of what Ava Sorala was doing when she stormed out of the cabinet. That led to a revolution. Mm-hmm. But it also, like, you know, if you can do it, don't throw your life away in meaningless moral gestures if you can help it. So. Back at the lake house, Eric and Peaches get to know each other a little bit better, which I found entertaining. While Amos takes a break to take his mind off things, the break helps him figure out the problem with the shuttle's reactor, which he's able to fix before all hell breaks loose and consumes the majority of the rest of the episode as the security team comes back with reinforcements. This is a long scene. I feel like we can just talk about it all. What'd you think?
Yeah, so this is where I start to lean, you know, towards Claire's side here, because she's talking about, you know, more about like including people in the tribe and this tribe of two stuff that they're trying to broaden, or she's trying to broaden. And she talks about like the mentality of keeping people out of the tribe, right? Making people prove to you that they're worth something before you will accept them. Whereas like giving people the space to sort of prove that without the hostility might actually be the thing that leads to everyone's benefit. I mean, that's essentially the point she's making is like, yeah, if you make them prove it before you ever give them a chance, they might never get the chance to prove it. That's like, there's this catch 22 sort of thing she's playing at, and I'm with her.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't see. So I think that Clarissa is right. And the only thing valid reason you can give to not help a person is that you literally can't.
Yeah.
You know, like if someone says, I need your heart. Well, my heart's still beating in my chest. And if I give it to you, I die. Mm-hmm. Like if someone wants to sacrifice that, to find they can't. But you can't compel someone to do that kind of sacrifice. I think the problem comes when you have when you have situations where you don't see that kind of stuff. When we're talking about like what you know, a lot of people today say we can't help people because we can't afford it, and what they really mean is that we can't afford it without a lot of sacrifices that I don't really want to give up. You know. And we're not talking about giving heart or blood or anything. We're talking about just like material comfort and sacrifices. Yeah. And the thing is neither side is like right or wrong. And like a universe, you know, the universe doesn't give a shit whether a person is selfish or, you know, whether they can actually give up stuff. And I guess that's everyone's like individual line. They have to decide where they draw it. But it does seem like there are times like, you know, where some people can't, you know, like if you got a boat that holds 10 people and you got 15 people need to put on it, like 5 people are going to die. Or you flood the boat and everyone dies. But those situations are, man, if you look back and rear view mirror of history, it seems like those things don't happen as much as we like to think they do. It's not, you know, it's not like the Titanic situation every fucking day. It's closer to this Clarissa situation.
Yeah, it's the context here is interesting to me because you're talking to the daughter of one of the richest men in the entire solar system, a girl who from birth has been pampered beyond imagination for a guy like Eric. And Eric himself has been shit on by life, you know, and he's made the best of what he can of that. But like he was not born with these advantages. And like, I don't know. This is the crazy thing about Claire. She's gone from that person who, you know, sees all those benefits as just like sort of taking them for granted, I think. You know, she didn't have her father's love, but God, all the other things she had. To someone who like sort of appreciates, I guess, you know, the idea that, oh, maybe my father should have been contributing more to the people of Baltimore. You know, perhaps he didn't need 15 space yachts and a house in a New Hampshire lake with another space yacht. And you know, research facilities on other planets and or on asteroids and the belt, like maybe he could have given up a little bit of that so that the people in Baltimore could have eaten for another day, you know?
Yeah.
Like that's the kind of shit where like, maybe we should, you know, he might kick us off this podcast. I'm not sure, but maybe we should tax Jeff Bezos a little bit more so that the homeless have a place to live. Maybe he doesn't need the 15th space yacht.
Yeah. Or like when there is so much want in the world, maybe there should be an upper limit to how much people. I don't know. Like I said, these are things we're figuring out. These are 21st century problems we have to figure out because, you know, right now all we got is the Earth and what we can divide up amongst ourselves for it.
The problem is that the sentiment here is like maybe giving them the chance, maybe not asking them to, you know, prove that they are valuable in the first place before we give them a chance. We'll give them actually the chance to prove. To not prove that they're valuable, but to contribute something else that you never would have got out of them had you been hostile since day one.
That a human has an inherent dignity and worth without them having to demonstrate that.
Right.
You know, my problem is, like I said, is like the only reason to not help a person is if you physically can't, like some kind of Titanic situation. The Clarissa's pulling all this shit in a literal Titanic situation.
Sure.
You know, like this boat is sinking and also armed men in another boat are coming and shooting at you to take your boat. Like, these people don't belong in a tribe. They probably need to be. That's what I'm saying. But I don't know whether the show, I feel like just by showing that and the fact that I have that interpretation shows that like they're thinking about it. But like, like I think that, you know, Amos is crazy. Clarissa is acting crazy. Holden is like there in the middle, like, you know, maybe. But maybe I'm also a little more psychopathic than Clarissa. Maybe that's possible too. Anyway, there's a lot of this. I really like Eric and Clarissa's talk. You know, there's the one that's the funny one that we already kind of talked about, their like tribe of they're growing the tribe conversation. But the one where he's like, why does he call you Peaches? She's like, I don't know. Why do you call him Timmy? Because that's his name. Should I ask about that? Probably not.
I wouldn't. Yeah.
Yeah. I just love that. Like, there's like probably so much mysterious backstory that they're just, you know, like, yeah, don't let a little bit of the mystery be with Amos, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. What did you think about the stunt work? Because that's like the majority of the episode. They get him in a real pincher move here. They're getting mm-hmm. they're taking fire from the front and the back. A superior force, superior position. They're fighting this fighting retreat.
It seems a little foolhardy on Amos's part. If you know that the guys with guns have been turned away, and you've said, "Hey, they're coming back," and you're just out here on a smoke break or whatever, right? Like you're just sitting out, no cover, no nothing, just hanging out, having conversations. You know, people are flirting outside. It's a little weird that they wouldn't be.
You are screaming at the horny street toughs to like stop being horny street toughs and get up on the roof and keep a lookout. But yeah, I mean,
sure. I don't know. I might want to keep everybody inside, take a break inside. But I there's a lot of like really cool stuff. I like this pincher maneuver, this flanking. I like, sort of this run and gun chase down the hall. It's really cool. Amos with the shotgun is sweet. I have some questions, maybe complaints, questions bordering complaints for later. But what do you think about it?
I thought it was great. There's a couple points where I thought Amos got shot, and I'm like, okay. What? Because he seems like he gets shot complaint. A lot.
Yeah.
But I think when in subsequent watches, what happened is a bullet hit the masonry right beside him, and that masonry like kind of like mm-hmm. shattered into his face, like
but
blinding.
Then he stands
and
out in the
him.
Open and then goes like, like he's been shot five times. Doesn't he?
Oh,
or
see,
is
I
that
thought
somebody
he.
Else?
No, you know, someone else gets shot like five times, but he does go out in the open and staggers around. But I think it's because he's been blind and you know stunned okay. from that, like you know, the thing. Because it was a little bit hard to see, and of course, you got to always remember these review copies. It's
they're shitty. Yeah,
little shitty, and like when it's really dark, it can get a little bit muddy. But I thought, yeah, mm-hmm. like it's a big shot, like a mostly one take. You know, on this big sprawling set and like, you know, watch him kind of move undercover and hustle everybody along. And like I said, do this kind of fighting, execute this fighting retreat. I thought it was really well done. I even thought it was a smart idea to have, you know, Clarissa butcher those 12 dudes off camera, because I think they're out of ways to make that look cool. You know,
agreed. I have questions around that, though, because every time we've seen Claire use her implant, she immediately drops to the floor, passed out cold.
She does
in
kind
this
of this
episode.
Time
she drops down to the floor and then gets back up, seemingly totally fine, gets into the pilot's chair, launches this ship, and then just gently falls asleep as they're rocketing toward the moon. Like it doesn't track with what we've seen before, the effects of this implant. And I don't know if that's because she has different settings or something, and she only needed like, I don't know, light dose to murder 12 people.
Delight. I feel like that there's been a little bit of, I'll give him a little bit of leeway, because what she actually did is she got drug onto the ship and put in a crash couch, and she had to push a couple buttons in, and when if she didn't, she's going to die. So she had adrenaline, you know, a little bit drips of adrenaline left in her system. I don't know.
Seen her be coherent after that in the past. Yeah. But
and to be fair, it seems like she didn't have to do much but push a button. The other problem I had is when the ship takes off, it like vaporizes the estate. And I'm like, well, how the fuck can this? But what I realized is they probably have all kinds of like ways to shunt those fumes away. They but do, like, yeah. You got to wait for the fucking doors to open and those
and
things.
And Eric like, is like, fuck this. I'm not waiting.
Yeah, he slams
the button.
So,
yeah.
So it doesn't happen that way every single time they take off. It's like that happens. It's kind of like, you
but
know,
it could
hey,
also like disposable yeah, like, launch pads built as these palatial estates, no problem. I believe that with Mal.
I feel like it vaporized the house too, though, is the problem.
And the butler's all replaceable. All replaceable on like a day worth of cash from the Mal Wachowski Enterprises.
There you go. Yeah, it's like, you know, oh, the Mal estate is posting for more help wanted. Oh, what happened? Oh, they did, you know. Jean-Pierre had to take off a little in a hurry, right. So you know how that goes. Guy got roasted skeleton.
I did find it strange that when they were headed toward the ship, the guy that they decide to hand Claire's limp body off to is Eric, who's having enough problems getting around
on his own. Yeah, he's hobbling around.
Carrying her body.
Yeah.
Weird.
But yeah, everybody, they roast the house, vaporizes all those private security contractors, get fucked, rent-a-cops. Everybody kind of more or less passes out as the ship achieves orbit. Except for Amos.
I think he climaxes.
I feel like this lighting and background is what they used on the poster for this season. You know, like Amos staring out at the hatch and seeing the sun coming over the wounded earth. That's the poster shot right here. We didn't talk a lot about it, but I really like Amos and this, I don't know her name, but Eric's lieutenant, you know, right-hand woman. Like what they said about leaving Baltimore, and initially he was afraid till he found a place to fit in, and him realizing you never start from scratch because you never fully leave everything behind. You take parts of that and those things that made you successful in those environments. You just find your place that those skills plug into, and you don't have to ever start from scratch. I thought that was a pretty cool way of looking at things. And I don't know, she did some standout work this episode. I wouldn't mind seeing more of her.
I think they patched her up.
Oh yeah, it seems like he was working on her. Yeah, he stabilized her is what I got out of that situation.
Okay.
Really good zero G pantomiming too. Like, you know, him pushing her stomach down and her raising her arms out to make it look like she's floating. I thought they're really sweating those details, and I really unironically appreciate it. It makes me feel a lot better that you guys are continuing to work on those things and selling that stuff. But yeah, I think that's it. We also have a final scene, or I guess two final scenes. Marco visits Philip once more to emotionally provoke him, this time with the knowledge that his mother's not only alive, but she saved herself just to abandon them again.
Bullshit. Philip knows this is not true. And I think that's why he's thrashing around so angry, is because he's still in the web of Marco, but also knows that he's talking a bunch of bullshit here.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I haven't quite got a pin on what Philip thinks and feels, you know, when he realizes he's backed the wrong horse. Because the thing is like, once he makes that realization, then he's just a cold blooded killer of millions and millions. And that's a huge psychological incentive to not face the truth. Holy shit. If I've ever heard one, I was just thinking, like, is the Rocinante's crew going to be just fucking bonkers? Are we going to have like Eric and Clarissa and Eric's lieutenant and also Philip? Like, are we going to double the crew of the Rocinante next season? Because it kind of sort of feels like all these people's arcs are kind of going to be on the Rocinante.
And you look at like what the Rossi crew looks like right now. Right. And where we started this season, where the Rossi's completely abandoned and Holden doesn't know what the fuck to do with himself. And now he's got this crew of, I don't know, 100. How many people are on the Rossi at this point?
I think it's like 20. I read that's like a full crew, like 20 Martian sailors and like 16 Marines. But the Marines, you know,
they wouldn't have those. Yeah. It makes you wonder, like, is Holden going to get used to that? Is he going to want more people? Like, is it Monica Bull? Like, how many people are going to end up being on the Rossi at the end of the season? All good questions. Philip, it feels like they're building to some sort of inevitable turning of the tables here. Some sort of kicking in of his conscience.
Yeah.
I won't like speculate on it, but I'm curious what you're thinking at this point about the future. Like, how is this Marco thing going to resolve? Does Philip step in? Does Holden come and just, you know, the duel to the death between the two? Is there, well, what are you thinking? How are you feeling about that?
Man, I do. If Sin was still alive, I'd say what I think was going to happen was, yes, Marco goes down either at Philip's hand or like some kind of battle. And then Philip, an old, you know, older, wiser, and with the guidance of his mentor Sin, is going to now lead this faction of the belt, and you know, get real, like surrender to the UN and get real belt. But I also think, because like I do think it's a little silly to think that all these people are going to be on the Rocinante. I mean, I Maybe that'll work. It'll just be Star Trek next season, where you got to try to juggle, you know, Dr. Crusher and Troy and Worf and Data and Geordi and Picard and Riker and fucking, yeah, Wesley's still in there too. Ensign Roe, sure, come on, you get a plot line. Like yeah. You just balance that, or maybe some people just, you know, are just kind of like in the background. But also, maybe Philip dies. You know, like he takes out his father, and that's like, you know, his penance for all the sins he's done. And he's kind of like an innocence that sacrifices himself, especially if he did that, like some kind of like what was Avis Serrallis, a spy guy, Cotiar? No,
either Cortazar or Cotiar. I can't remember which is,
well, one of them is
the
crazy protomolecule guy.
Right.
But like if he did some kind of like public on channel, like sacrifice to save like the inners. Man, that seems like it'd be a moment that you could, you know, it reminds me of like I was listening to Dan Carlin's Countdown to Armageddon, that the first Christmas in the trenches, where spontaneously on Christmas Eve, all the troops from the German and the French and English side came out of their trenches and sang Christmas songs and gave each other gifts and stuff. Like that could have been the end of the war, probably. Instead, both sides viciously cut down and said, there will be no more celebrating Christmas or peace on earth or goodwill towards any man in these trenches. So like, but like some kind of moment that Philip could engineer and some kind of sacrifice, like there's not a lot of people that could do it, but Marco's own son. So I don't know. That's what I'm thinking. You going to tell me which one's okay. Right?
No, of course not. Of course not.
Philip's going to become Macho Peru. And that's the puzzle piece that all the fucking book readers have been waiting. He's gonna shack up with Monica, and they will be together. Them stacked on, standing on each other's shoulders in a trench coat will be Macho Peru.
Yes.
I've cracked the code.
Good job.
All right. Naomi, the whole episode, she's been working these bare wires, and I'm like, I know what she's going to do. She rigs up her helmet to see and uses her HUD to show her essentially the sensors from outside the ship. And it's a great performance because she's simultaneously moved that her friends are coming to rescue her and also gutted that they're going to die for their love and affection for her. And that's a hard thing to do, pull those emotions and display them at the same time. But she does it. Yeah. Then her despair gives way to inspiration as drops of water fall on her head. And she grabs a tool and with firm resolve goes into the inner hull of the ship and starts banging on things. And so is this in the book? Because I kind of want to ask you what the hell's going on. But if you know, then fuck off. So
here's the thing. It might be in the book, but I legitimately don't remember. Like everything after Naomi gets this message out until the resolution of all of this stuff, I think it happens the same way, but honestly, I couldn't tell you. So
what is she going to do? What is she going to do with water? The only thing I can think of, I don't know, like
short circuit some shit, malfunction,
short circuit some
proximity
shit,
sensors.
Can she hook up water and squirt it outside a nozzle, like reroute it to some kind of like waste exhaust and induce the ship to spin in some direction?
What does that get her if she spins the ship? It's still going to blow up in her friends' faces. Like,
right. Can she take liquid and write on a window? I don't know. I don't know. Because the only thing I can think of is like she can drink, which she needs to. She's dying of thirst, but that's not going to solve her immediate problem. The only thing I can think of is water also has a lot of mass and it can be a reaction mass. Mm-hmm. You can somehow turn it to steam, vent it to the outside of the ship, get it to do something that's not supposed to be to kind of show that it's. You know, I don't know. Like, is there a universal spin you can put on a ship that implies distress? Like, stay away, or
yeah, some belter symbol like they do with the hand gestures, except ship gestures.
Like, wait a second, this has got a quarter twist with a half arc rotation. This is the standard belter. Stay away.
But you got two Martians on the ship that's approaching, right? It's not going to help. So.
Right, right.
I don't know. I'm really at a loss.
Can you shoot out water to spell like SOS, you know, like three long streams of water, three small. But then they already know she's in distress.
Right. That's why they're coming to save her.
So I'm saying it's something she's banging on pipes, and not in kind of a rhythm. It just feels like it's like the kind of rhythm you do if you're banging it as hard as you can. So she's trying to break
shake off some water, I assume, like larger quantities of it.
So I don't know. I guess I'll be a little disappointed if she just shorts out these tamper resistance things, because like if you can short out a tamper resistant seal and deactivate it, it's a really bad tamper resistant seal. Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, that's the end of the episode.
I'm as puzzled as you are.
Loud rhythmic banging.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
All right, we've got some feedback this week. It's all from 507, because 508 hasn't dropped yet as of the recording of this episode, 509. So, you know, it's going to be all stuff that's like not super plot relevant, though it might give us like perspective and questions that we had. Maybe it can give us
things
some answers.
Might have missed, yeah.
Yeah, things like that. If you would like to send in feedback to the show, and actually this is a good time to do it because we're probably going to be watching episode 10, the finale, live with everybody else. So we'll have some time to actually consider relevant recent feedback. Send that in to expanse@baldmove.com. And we will pick it up for the finale.
Yeah, So our expectation for the finale is that we'll have this out Thursday night,
a couple of days after show airs.
If we happen to get a screener in the last week, then we'll probably go ahead and record it, and then you'll know because it'll drop at the exact same time, and we'll explain the situation. But yeah. if you come up on Tuesday night and expecting the podcast, it's not going to be there because at this point we don't have it and probably won't get it. They're holding that finale because they don't want us knowing. They don't want anyone knowing. They don't trust us to know what Naomi's doing banging on them pipes.
Yeah, we couldn't resist the spoilers. We'd have to get it out there. All right, we start off with Matt H., who says, during your episode discussion, you considered the question of whether Marco considered Tycho Station a target and whether he had interest in its destruction. The answer to both questions has to be absolutely yes, considering his plan and what would have happened had it played out. The code written into the Rossi to destroy it does so via reactor core malfunction, which creates an explosion of nuclear proportion. The Rossi's docked at Tycho Station, and it would have blown in its dock with all of Tycho within the blast radius. Marco knew all of this, so Tycho being destroyed was part of the plot. Which, is that strange if destroying Tycho Station is part of the plot, he also wanted to personally assassinate Fred Johnson? and he would have all of his compatriots and collaborators on Tycho Station at the time.
Maybe it was to decapitate the leadership so they could effectuate the getaway. I mean, that's like always a good, you know, to take out the decapitate the leadership of the other side. And the plan was for all of his loyal people to get away on that thing. So, like, yeah, because, well, I was thinking, well, wait a second. Why? What about his people? Are they like really down in like a, you know, fucking Brotherhood Bane from Batman way of like, oh, I guess I have to die for the cause? Maybe. I mean, people roll off the assembly line like that, or turn towards that, towards propaganda. But like, I didn't get that feel. But this person's absolutely right. We've seen how reactor breaches go in this show, and it is a fucking fusion bomb. So
yeah, and I would say, you know, maybe they need to assassinate Fred personally, because he might not be on the part of the station that would be super affected by the explosion. I don't know exactly how big that explosion would be, if it could destroy all of Tycho Station. But yeah, think about the Nauvoo, right? It was within like a dock at Tycho Station, wasn't it? Like the space dock there?
It was on the outside. It was like docked, like, you know, like on one of those real long gantries away from the station. But the Rossi is like on its outer ring too, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not like it's inside the hangar. Or was it? No, it was inside getting refitted. It was inside getting, so it was inside the hangar.
Yeah.
I imagine if you put off a fusion bomb inside that hangar, it would take out most of the station, and what's left would probably not survive very long.
Yeah. So then why assassinate Fred personally? Why walk up to him with a gun and blast him three, four times, whatever? Strange.
Oh, to piss off to ensure the Rocinante comes after you? Because you want to like do something so heinous, like take the like really, you know, like get them so pissed off that they do like don't think about things, don't think it through, and just go forward
and timing,
enrage them,
like to hasten timing. the launch of the Rossi.
Taking out the commander of the station probably is not a bad idea if you're trying to like weaken its security and get away scot free, cause confusion.
You're trying to steal Monica.
Yeah, if you're trying to steal Monica, whatever reason. The proto Monica.
Matt continues, your discussion about what Naomi is doing, going to do is interesting. On one hand, what is she going to do? But I saw it as another impossible choice she made just to get away from Marco. If she died, at least she didn't do it having just watched her beloved ship and crew murdered. She wouldn't be killed by her enemy, likely being spaced into the wreckage of his victory. It would be on her own terms and on her own ship away from Marco. I also wonder if she will just be assumed dead. No, I think all that's like a little bit of dry pie here.
That's the thing. The assumed dead is like, that was clever. Good take, because I didn't see it coming. So congratulations to just having the obvious take of like a woman left a spaceship without a spacesuit on. Oh boy, I guess she's going to die, you know?
Yeah.
What was the first point before we got to the...
It was just about like, what's Naomi going to do here? She's going to be killed one way or another. Why not jump out of the ship? Is that...
Oh, so yeah, like... That's different, like, because that's a different take than like someone killing themselves because they're too emotionally wrought to go on. Mm-hmm. Like, this is kind of like, if I'm interpreting their words correctly, they're suggesting this is kind of like Naomi's ultimate walk away. Like, she either walks away and gets on the ship and then lives to fight another day, or she no longer participates in Marco's sick scheme to kill her friends and then lord it over her and do and force his son to throw his mother out of an airlock or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's not a meaningless, it's not like, oh, I can't go on. It's more of like, I'm denying you my utility and your plan. So I like that. Yeah. It's not just a merely suicidal gesture either way.
All right. Then a totally different Matt, not the same Matt. The other one had an H. This one has an A. Hey guys, really enjoying this season, enjoying the podcast along with it. I wanted to discuss the quote unquote sloppiness of Naomi's door access twice now this season. He's talking about when she is in the airlock in the first place. Twice now this season, we have seen scenes of Marco and Holden granting door access to people on their respective ships. You mentioned the Holden scene in the episode commentary, and it really struck me how seemingly pointless the scene was, which meant it must be important. I firmly believe the show is telling us to not infer the negative, i.e. if Marco remembered to take her door access, they would have shown us. So instead of sloppiness, an artistic decision which may or may not resonate.
I mean, it's still like if you're Marco and you forget to restrict this person who has every reason to go and fuck with your ship.
And already has.
And and not with a plan. Like, it's not like he had her followed to make sure that, like, you know, as soon as she does, he can confront Philip with the evidence. Like, or maybe he did because Sin was watching her. Maybe that's the plan. Like, he wanted her to do something and prove, like, see, she's going to sabotage. But I don't know, man. Like, at that point, he had already had his son slap his mother, say you're a traitor to the cause, and we're going to space you as soon as we execute your space boyfriend. It still feels like an oversight. Like if Monica tried to kill Bull with a hydro spanner, and then he slaps her around and says, look, as soon as we blow up the Zamea, I'm going to throw you in a spacesuit and lock you, and then forgets to revoke her. You'd be like, Jim's crazy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is a massive oversight. I feel like I'm still not backing away from. But Marco could be. The show might not be sloppy. They could just be suggesting that Marco's overconfident and sloppy, which I would believe.
Yeah. And trying to once and for all, you know, cement his son's hatred of his mother.
Because he does not like his son having sympathy with her at all. Not one little bit. That's one thing they've consistently shown that's driving him crazy, that he's even giving his mother's side a shot. You know, that's scary to Marco.
I just wish they would have made that a little clearer in the episode. I still think it's sloppy, even if it makes a certain amount of sense.
Yeah, if she walks away and, you know, Philip turns to Marco and be like, you're just going to let her walk around after what she did to Sin and all that. And he says, no, Sin, keep an eye on her. I want you to shadow her and make sure, like, again, it feels like there's no fatal problem. This is like the third time I've said this in the season. Like, man, it feels like there should be a 5 or 10 second insert to not let us kind of twist in the wind and speculate. But we're not getting those this season.
Jessica writes in and wants to talk about a detail she noticed, which is kind of a hallmark of this show. She says, I noticed something very cool in this episode. If I saw what I think I did, there are a few emotional occasions throughout the episode, all with Naomi in them, where it appears that the characters are emotional to the point of tears. In the scene of Marco and Naomi speaking in her holding cell, as well as when Naomi's in Philip's room, it appears the actor's eyes well with tears, but those tears never fall, which happens because of zero G, right? This is indeed what the show, what was happening in the show. It's incredibly cool detail to include. Yeah, they've done this a few times. If you remember back to, I think, season 3 with like Anna and Victoria, is that her name?
Velavilov.
Yeah, Velavilov, and also when she was her friend.
When she was dying, like impaled in the, I feel like that their eyes, and you could kind of see the tears, the tear film sloshing around their eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. It goes all the way back to the sci-fi days of The Expanse, right? It's not something new that they're doing here, but it is very cool.
I do think, though, I didn't see that effect this, because I do think most of the times you see people crying this episode, they're under thrust.
Right. Which forces the tears down and out of their eyes.
Yeah. That provides an artificial type of gravity.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mike in St. Louis says, while you guys deliver as usual, I gotta admit I'm concerned about the show delivering in its final season and a third. Last week's episode, Oh Ya Dang, was, in my opinion, good, not great. I'm with you guys when you say that they can't all be bangers and that the show needs slower episodes with character development to set up the big ones. But with an estimated 13-ish episodes left in Amazon's rendition of the show, I don't want to spend a lot of time on familial and interpersonal connections. Oh boy, Mike, I'm not sure I can follow you down this path, but let's see the rest of the email here. With the Mars Belter plot, a burning Earth, no time spent on the Ring Gate or new planets, and the big arc of the protomolecules connection to two ancient civilizations, there's so much left to tell. I'm a lore hound like Aaron, so call me cynical, but with so little time left in Amazon's run, I can't help but feel we'll be dissatisfied with the conclusion of season 6, much like... come on, man. Game of Thrones. We won't be dissatisfied in that way. They might not get to every detail, but that was a uniquely bad ending to a great show.
And I got to say, one of its big problems is it chiefly abandoned the character moments that were the hallmark of the show for just battles, plot. Like the highest regarded episode of that final season is Knight of the Realm, right? Or a Knight of the Realm, the one where Jaime knights Brienne, because it did give people a chance to all of our old friends to go around and cement those relationships, remind us what the stakes are. So I feel the fan, like, you want your show to stick to landing. Mm-hmm. And you already have a minor disappointment, which is this: the third trilogy of trilogies is not going to be made, or at least there's no plans at this time. So you're really gripped up and wanting this to be, you know, end an amazing note. And some of these shows, like, I honestly, I'm a little like 10% worried, because not that the show is going to be like a Game of Thrones style disaster. But where there's two or three things this season that kind of like bother me, and that I've like a little bit of shorthand, a little bit of, but every great show I've ever watched has a few of these episodes. Sometimes they're just missteps. Sometimes they're just necessary to like make that emotional stakes land. But I think, like I said, I understand why you're gripped up, but I do feel like these people have built up a lot of credibility and trust with me, that I don't think it's going to be a Game of Thrones style debacle where the entire fan base essentially turns against the show and wants no more of it. But it could be. Yeah.
I can't imagine.
And again, if you don't have the emotion, you know, there's no reason for action to be happening. You know, there's no reason to care about the action. That's why, like, you know, I didn't like the Nolan's latest movie, Tenet, because I had a protagonist that was doing things I had no idea why.
Yeah, he literally didn't have a name.
He was doing it for. No,
in the movie.
He's just a protagonist. Mm-hmm. And they gave him like a personal relationship, because I think they even Nolan realized, like, if he's literally got no reason to do this, but like, why did he, you know, it's like. So, and you put that in, kind of, you know, like, Inception's a lot of the same movie, but, you know, I really cared about Mal and his kids' relationship and him getting mm-hmm. back and him grieving his wife and the guilt that he felt over that. Like, Memento, you know, this guy's had not just his wife, you know, wife killed, his entire life, his identity stolen from him, his memory, and like trying to get that back with that condition, extremely gripping.
Mike in his email mentions Breaking Bad as an example of a ending that they stuck. And I think Breaking Bad's ending sticking and landing is largely on the back of the emotional payload that that thing delivers. Like, you know, having Walt Jr. taken care of, right? Like, doing some of the things he said he wanted to do when he set out on this journey, mm-hmm. I think is the emotional payload you needed at the ending of that to make it count. And in the meantime, you got to connect some emotional dots. Look, if we can get as much action as we've had in the past couple of episodes here, because you do get a lot of Rossi porn, right? Like spaceship combat stuff going on between the Zemea and the Rossi. Like, that stuff is cool. I don't know why. I don't feel like the balance is off here.
Mm-mm. Especially since, like, and we got this nice long action scene in this episode too that I thought was pretty satisfying. I'm not concerned. Like, 10% worry is like my average kind of worry going into any show that I love, if because, you know, it's always possible to fuck it up, but I just can't. Yeah, the pieces are all here, you know, and having these connections built and this the stakes, because if Marco's just a terrorist, it's throwing rocks at Earth. He's kind of just like, you know, this faceless goon. He's just a cartoonishly evil guy. His connection to Naomi mm-hmm. and the battle for their son's soul is what connects you to it, is what makes you care about, you know, this action. So we needed that, or he's just like, why not use Anderson Dawes? Like, why introduce this new just purely mustache twirling villain that we never have any insight into his crew or his personality or what drives him or his history? It's inherently more fascinating by getting this information. And also, it's a lot sweeter to see Naomi driving him this crazy because it's the one thing he can't control in his whole life. Like, her victories over him feel so much sweeter than just a fleet action, you know?
Sure.
Like, how emotionally would you rather have given up the Naomi scenes for being able to see these five golden bow ships get torn up by two UN cruisers and a Martian frigate, and those you know, those people dying that you had no, you know what I mean? Like, they could do that, but I think the show would be lesser for it.
Yeah, so. I certainly do. I think, like, you know, reasonable people can disagree. I think there are a lot of people who want to see more space battles, who want to see a bunch of cool shit, cool sci-fi shit happening. And I'm with you. I want to see that too, but I don't want to necessarily shortchange the emotional side of it just to get to that stuff.
And I'm comparing this fifth season with like season six and seven of Game of Thrones. Like, there was 10 times more problems that we were all looking past. Like, things got uncharacteristically sloppy and stupid. Like, it wasn't just like a minor, like, does this floor grate really going to be unsecured? It's more of like, dude ran from like the wall at King's Landing in 3 minutes. What the fuck happened going on here? You know, Danny forgot about this guy having 100 fucking ships with crossbows that can kill her dragon. Like, just stupid shit. Like, if Holden just like next episode takes a Rocinante right into the teeth of this fleet and gets them all killed. Like, that's the kind of lapses that we're talking about. And we're just not seeing, you know, these as many and as big of logical lapses in this final, this penultimate season, in my opinion.
I will say, Mike, I'm with you because I've you say you're not a book reader, so you don't know where this is going. I have read through book six, which I assume is where they're going to leave off season six of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still up in the air about a lot of things. There are a lot of questions I have, particularly important questions, too. That the show may or may not have dealt with already. The proto molecule being one of them. How wise of a decision is it to, you know, I'm taking for granted that it was a decision that they made to sort of put some, you know, confusion around whether or not the proto molecule is in fact destroyed. It seems like the show is leaving a door open here, but maybe they're not intentionally doing that. Maybe they're trying in every way they can to say, no, look at this explosion. It definitely destroyed the proto molecule. There was no way they could have dropped it off in the meantime. It's gone. Maybe they're trying to say that, and I'm just not picking it up because
that's what I'm getting.
I want to believe or something, but like, I'm not certain. I think there's still doubt as to whether or not somehow the Zemea. But maybe I'm only doubting it because like a lot of people are emailing in with their doubts, and I'm like, okay, leave that door open. But
okay, shall we consider perhaps?
Yeah. I mean, that's part of what he's talking about here. You know, the proto molecules. Connection to the two ancient civilizations, like if their sample of the proto molecule is gone, I guess they'd have to go through like a ring gate to see any more of it, right?
Or like we haven't seen any proto molecule in its raw form. Like the machines themselves are not proto molecule. You know, those, like, they don't have proto molecule coursing through them. Like I said, Marco sure seems to act and believe like he doesn't have the protomolecule anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's what I keep going back to. Like, why would he be keeping up this farce of like, oh, my God, we got the Zemea destroyed. And we weren't able to get the, you know, like, why? But then again, they got the scientist. I don't know. Maybe he's got. Who knows? Who knows? Yeah, I just feel like the show like
pocketed some.
Yeah, I would be weirded out if the show brought it back, but I also don't. Yeah, I don't. I'm not a book reader, so all that's wildly interesting, I would say.
Yeah.
For me.
Okay, and let's go to the last one here. John H says, in the last podcast, you suggested that Naomi is pregnant in her secret message. Don't forget.
I said that's a possibility. I did not suggest it's.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Okay.
That's another door left open. Don't forget, Holden's original lover on the Canterbury may have been pregnant when she was killed with the can.
Oh, damn.
The writers would have to be very cruel to hit Holden with a dead pregnant lover twice.
Double ghost wounds. How do you recover from that? Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Maybe you don't. but I don't know. I don't know. There hasn't really been much of any mention of that possibility since. So,
yeah, and I think that, like I said, that was just something I'd throw out there because they have left it an intentional mystery. You know, we saw that she sent it. We saw that he received it. He, I think, went to open his mouth to talk about it, and then it was interrupted immediately by the chase of the Zemea, or he's refused to let us know what it is. So, like, I, you know, But I think the show's also consistently said that Holden can't have kids because of his heavy dose of gamma radiation he got on Eros. So
yeah,
and his constant cancer medicine he has to take for the rest of his life to keep tumors from growing on his testicles.
Yeah, but I also wouldn't put it past the Corys to be especially cruel. That seems like something they could dip into.
Punish Holden.
Yeah, for his insolence. I don't know, his naivete,
for his paladin bullshit, mm-hmm. annoying the party.
All right, that's it. That's it for the episode.
All right, send us that feedback in for the final episode. I'm not. I. You want to commit to doing a wrap up? I kind of do. Like, yeah, if you've got going to be have a lot of questions going into season six, I imagine people have a lot. So, like, the final episode will not be our final podcast. It will have the next week. We'll have like a little roundup for feedback. That's going to be a lot of your guys' show. So send in feedback for the finale episode and for our wrap-up podcast, expanse@baldmove.com. We'll consider it. And yeah, we're really looking forward to, I'm really looking, this is going to go a long wait. I don't have to wait for 2 weeks for it.
Yeah.
We'll get it. And again, final reminder, our podcast will probably be at the following Thursday after the Tuesday that it's traditionally released, to give us time to actually watch it a couple times and get a good podcast together for it. And I hope you join us then. Until then, we'll see you on the next time. And I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.